NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and here are some of the voices from this week's top news stories.
It is estimated that by 2020, as much as 18% of our fuel mix could come from tar sands-derived fuels. Tar sands-derived fuels is much more carbon-intensive than conventional fuel.
Individuals who have applications in will now be able to take their application, acceptance letter, their old license plate, to the local DMV substation and turn those things in and begin the process to receive a vanity plate.
This could be a plateau. We did see some leveling off of the migration numbers in late 2013, and then we saw a big reversal.
She knows who to reach out to in the state to get New Hampshire position, the people's position on an issue.
From the top, that was Jim Murphy with the National Wildlife Federation at the Northeast Energy Summit on his concerns over Canadian tar sands oil. Michael Todd with the New Hampshire Division of Motor Vehicles announcing that Granite Staters may, once again, apply for vanity plates. PSNH spokesman Martin Murray on the so-called migration of former PSNH customers to other electric suppliers. And retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Gail Prince on her endorsement of Senator Jean Shaheen as Shaheen and other U.S. Senate candidates competed this week for veterans' votes. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, we'll look at these stories and more, and let's hear from you, too. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Kevin Landergan, Statehouse reporter, columnist with the Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be back, Laura.
Also with us, Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. And Jeff, welcome.
Thanks, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civics column in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back as always.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, energy issues seem to dominate this week in New Hampshire, especially earlier in the week. And we'll get to the details in just a moment. But Jeff Feingold, I'd love for you to give us the big picture here. What's at stake? What are the tensions? And why are we hearing so much these days about energy?
Well, actually, it's interesting because energy has become the issue that's just gone to the top of the agenda of so many stakeholders, I guess is a good word, in New Hampshire, especially in the business community. New Hampshire has among the highest electric rates in the country, and that's been, you know, historically true for a very long time. And what's coming into play here is that most of our electricity at this point is now being generated, or a lot of it's being generated by natural gas. And New Hampshire and New England is at the end of this pipeline of natural gas. So the supply of natural gas is not exactly consistent, as we saw over this winter, where electric rates for people who had non-PSNH or electric ratepayers were just hammered with these unbelievable, like triple their price of their rates. So there's a inconsistent supply of natural gas. Public service has its own generating facilities, most notably its Merrimack Station coal-burning plant in Bow. And that's coming under fire from people who would like to see them either close the Merrimack plant or say PSNH should divest its generating facilities. It's the only utility in New England that has its own generating facilities still.
So it's interesting, Jeff, you know, at a time nationally when we hear headlines about, you know, U.S. energy independence and, you know, all this natural gas, and we may even end up exporting some of it. Here in New England, it's a very different picture.
It's a very different picture, and we're very, in many ways, vulnerable. Because we do have we don't have oil pipelines, we don't have our own coal, we have a lot of biomass, otherwise known as trees, but there's certainly not enough facilities that are burning that, And you know, and then we have this issue looming over. You know, one of the solutions that people see is this Northern Pass project to bring down just, you know, huge quantities of hydropower generated up in Canada through New Hampshire to supply New England. But that's obviously very, very controversial, and it's still a long way from becoming a reality.
Yeah, a lot of tensions here, Kevin. I mean, so many ideas about how to improve New England's energy picture, but just as much opposition to those ideas because they all come with trade-offs.
Yeah, I mean, certainly trying to expand the capacity for affordable energy is something any elected official would want to be for, but the devil's always in the details, and often governors or members of Congress find that there's significant opposition to bringing these projects through your home state, as we're seeing here in Northern Pass, and other states have experienced as well. That was what was so striking about the summit to me up in Bretton Woods was it's kind of a metaphor for Governor Maggie Hassan and the dilemma she has with regard to Northern Pass. She appeared at protests for both opponents of the project and supporters of the project. Why? Because essentially she would like more energy to come into New Hampshire and supports the concept of more energy coming here, but doesn't support this current corridor and proposal. She wants the lines of Northern Pass buried underground along states of rights away, and she also wants some assurance that New Hampshire ratepayers will receive from some benefit from all this energy coming through New Hampshire.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something that Kevin mentioned. New Hampshire Business Review had an interview with Bill Quinlan, who's the president of PSNH, in our current issue, and he kind of said something very interesting because he acknowledged that there's obviously a lot of opposition to Northern Pass, and he's been apparently trying to meet with environmental groups and people up in the North Country in particular who are against it just to kind of have some kind of line of communication. But he did mention to us that perhaps what he might be thinking about is possibly trying to get a guarantee of a certain percentage of that Northern Pass transmitted energy would be guaranteed to be used in New Hampshire, which is something that hasn't really been mentioned before. And that is, I believe, something that a lot of people who are opposing the line are using this as an argument, as Kevin implied. You know, if we don't get any of the benefits, why are we building it? But if there is some kind of way to say New Hampshire is going to benefit from this with energy, you know, maybe there'll be some of the opposition will be weakened.
Interesting. And Dean, I want to hear from you too, but let me also remind our listeners that you can join us. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. We're looking at all the big stories from the news around the Granite State this week, including the one we're talking about right now, ongoing debate about energy issues. A little bit later, we'll talk about New Hampshire's new unemployment rate. It's looking pretty low, and later on, we'll catch up on this fall's elections. Join us now with your questions and comments on these and other stories from the week that caught your attention. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dean Spiliotis, just picking up on what Kevin mentioned, Maggie Hassan having to walk a very careful line when it comes to Northern Pass. I'd love your thoughts on all political officials and how they are approaching this energy difficulty that Jeff laid out for us.
Yeah, it's a real challenge, and I think it's been a real challenge for Governor Hassan over the past almost 2 years now to kind of articulate a comprehensive energy plan because there are these political tensions that she has to deal with. She's pulled in one direction towards economic development, and she's been very outspoken about that. But she's also pulled in the other direction by environmental groups, by alternative energy groups. We've seen some problems in the state with wind power, for example. There's been a lot of difficulty getting these big wind projects up and running. Solar is still not self-sustaining financially. It relies heavily on federal subsidies. She's not necessarily caught between a rock and a hard place, but on the other hand, she has these kind of competing demands on her, and I've sort of had a sense that she has sort of avoided kind of being pinned down on exactly what the mix should be as much as possible. You know, the summit that they had up in Bretton Woods, I think there was one a year ago as well. You know, they get together. It was New England governors and a couple of Canadian premiers, and they create these kind of non-binding resolutions. And my sense of the recent summit this past week is that, you know, not a lot concrete came out of it, but the protesting was what was really interesting. The opposition to tar sands and Northern Pass and, environmental opposition is one area where groups can often be quite effective. And they are on kind of her left flank politically, but she does have to pay attention to them to some extent.
Jeff, real quick, and then another question for you, Dean.
There's another issue that's bubbling up besides Northern Pass and the tar sands is that this proposed construction of a gas pipeline, natural gas pipeline, which has found a lot of opposition in Massachusetts and also in Hollis.
Yeah, the Telegraph had an article earlier this week on Hollis's concerns.
And that's an issue that is obviously it's not at the top right now. Northern Pass is the biggie. But this is something that could really hurt any politician. It doesn't matter if it's the governor or anybody else, because there was a meeting the other day in Hollis. I guess everybody who showed up was against it.
Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, I think that's why you saw these summits by the New England governors and Canadian premiers always move glacially at best in terms of whatever they do. But particularly in election year, you have elections for governor in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, in Maine, a vacant position in Massachusetts. So you've got all these governors or departing governors all not wanting to make any commitment now, only months before they're going to go before the voters.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. You know, Dean, as we look again at the political angle of this, we've talked about Governor Hassan, but some of these decisions have federal involvement. So this affects our members of Congress. Whoever ends up winning, you know, those two seats and the Senate race. Members of Congress have to look at this, too. The Federal Department of Energy is involved. When it comes to Northern Pass, the State Department might even be involved because you're talking about crossing national borders. So they have to walk this line, too.
Absolutely. And a lot of what we've been waiting on for Northern Pass is the federal government studying the various alternatives for running these power lines. Sure, you know, kind of at the federal level, energy policy tends to break down fairly predictably between Republicans and Democrats. There typically aren't any great surprises there. But, you know, the sort of tension between increased domestic exploration, more opportunity for fracking in certain states where there are these various reserves that can be reached, and then kind of a Democratic opposition being driven by environmental groups to some extent, but also the push for alternative fuels. And, you know, President Obama has tried to shift somewhat towards his alternative fuels, but he ran into trouble with the solar energy. And again, wind continues to be problematic. Another option that I often see in New Hampshire is geothermal energy, which you drill down deeply into the earth. It long-term, it may be beneficial, but it's pretty expensive to implement up front.
And that's done more on an individual homeowner basis.
Yes,
too.
Or
nobody's
a business.
Talking about the grid
right,
here.
Right, yeah. Right. It's not a grid, right.
Okay. Did you want to jump in super quick, Jeff? Or?
No, but I will if you want me
to. No, we're good. We're going to head into a super short break. When we come back, another issue that definitely caught our attention on the exchange, the question of whether the Northeast is now saturated with casino gambling. Kevin Landergan looked at this question. We'll talk about what it means for the gambling debate in New Hampshire. We've also put Kevin's article up on our Facebook page. You can check it out. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. We'll get your thoughts on this and other topics in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. An HPR summer car raffle is underway. We're giving away some great prizes, including a new car later this summer. But when you get your tickets today, your name goes into the drawing for the early bird prize, $2,000 in Irving Oil and Gas gift cards. And if you're the winner, your name goes back in the hat for the other prizes, but only when you get your raffle tickets at nhpr.org. Partly to mostly sunny today, highs upper 70s to lower 80s, mostly clear tonight, areas of fog after midnight, lows upper 40s north, upper 50s in the south, and a nice weekend coming up. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank, banking solutions customized to your business, information available at centrixbank.com. And Downs Racklin Martin offering statewide trust and estate services with attorneys Tom Shatari, Jake Wheeler, and Wilhelmine Digmans Miller. Information at drm.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. Among them, the continuing question about where New Hampshire and New England are going to get their energy from. We'll also catch up a little bit later on politics. Jeb Bush tweeted that he supports Scott Brown. Veterans, a group of them, came out for Jean Shaheen. We'll find out more in just a moment. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Kevin Landergan, Jeff Feingold, Dean Spiliotis. Let's go to our listeners. And Michael's joining us from Plymouth. Hi, Michael. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning. My thing is that I've seen energy lines and pipelines go through the hard way and the easy way. The arrogance of business is their problem. When when a point man comes up and says, we're going to use eminent domain, you've just declared war on everybody in sight. So instead of that, have them banish those words, ask people, where would you like it? And strangely enough, when nuclear plants started offering the people within a radius of them free electricity, everyone said, build it.
You know, Michael, this is a good point. And Kevin Landrigan, this came up with the pipeline discussion in Hollis. You know, people said don't take property by eminent domain. And people are worried about being shut out of the process.
Right. And in New Hampshire, that also led to legislation with regard to these transmission projects some years ago, and even a constitutional amendment that passed, which essentially said you can't use eminent domain to take property, particularly for projects that aren't there isn't a justifiable need for that project. That's really the benchmark. And that really grew out of concerns with Northern Pass when they were first coming into the state and buying up land along the corridor.
Yeah, and that's a good point that Michael made is that, you know, this is New Hampshire, and people don't like being told what to do. They certainly liked being told, I'm going to take your property and here's what I'm paying you for it. That's not an issue in New Hampshire. That's not a good issue in New Hampshire. So I think there is something to be said. There's a really serious public relations problem that the energy companies, the utilities have had for many years. You know, in New Hampshire, it goes back to Seabrook, where they still have not recovered from that image. And, you know, it's something that it's really funny how they keep repeating the mistakes of the past. It's really just very it's educational.
Thank you very much for the call, Michael. Again, our number for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. In just a moment, gentlemen, I do want to ask about Kevin's piece, Casino Gambling Saturation. But another headline first, Dean Spiliotis, good news surrounding New Hampshire's economy this week. Our unemployment rate for June was at 4.4%. 4.4%. Not bad, Dean.
Yeah, not bad at all. The May rate was also 4.4% after it was revised, which is often the case with these numbers. A year ago in June, it was 5.2%. So we've come down almost a point and a half. Nationally, it's still at 6.1%. So clearly, you know, the numbers are encouraging. If you listen to the debate over these numbers at the federal level, there's a lot of talk about people dropping out of the workforce, that the true unemployment rate is actually up around 12%. There are different versions of these national numbers that come out based on the population that they're looking at. But nonetheless, I think regardless of the debate over how many people are in or out of the workforce, it's certainly trending in the right direction and has been for some time now. I think particularly federally, there was over 200,000 jobs reported in the last month, which is sort of a minimum of number for them.
Jeff, go ahead, jump in.
I was going to say that, you know, the number of 4.4 is a, you know, it's not a bad number. It's somewhat encouraging, but, you know, that it's got a saying at 4.4 is not encouraging. The other thing is that we have to remember that New Hampshire has for many years had unemployment rates below 3%. So 4.4 is pretty high for New Hampshire. And the other thing is, out of these numbers, it turns out that 1,500 people left the labor force in June, and which is what Dean was talking about nationally. And that's pretty discouraging. Those are people who are discouraged and say, we're not trying anymore, which also could mean that that's why the unemployment rate was staying at 4.4. There are significant issues involving New Hampshire's economy. And it's one of them is that there's still not any kind of robust manufacturing employment. Construction industry is still pretty stagnant, and those are two of the big economic engines in New Hampshire.
Kevin, go ahead.
No, I was just going to echo what Jeff was saying about the labor force because, I mean, he's the expert, but employers I talk to—
Don't call me that.
Employers I talk to and elected officials essentially all say the same thing about New Hampshire's economy. What's the problem with the economic recovery? And it's we can't find the workers even if we want to add jobs here. And with the workforce has grown since a year ago, but Jeff is right. Just this past month, the workforce dropped by over 1,000 people, and there were 1,200 people fewer who were unemployed. So that's why it stayed at 4.4.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned manufacturing, Jeff, and there was a headline this week. A gun maker, Sig Sauer, announced layoffs, about 10% of its New Hampshire workforce. Just remind us what kind of a presence Sig Sauer has here in the Granite State.
Yeah,
it's pretty big.
It's a pretty big company. It's one of the biggest gun makers in the world. It's a German-based company. They have a plant. They have a new facility at Pease. And they've been very successful, you know, as all gun manufacturers have been the last several years, basically since President Obama was elected. I don't think we need to go into the whole discussion about why that's popular. You know, with the fear of gun control and all that, sales of firearms just shot up, no pun intended. But it's something that is reflective of what's going on in the whole industry. On the other side of the state, in Newport, there's a small machining company called Latva Machine. They have about 50 employees. They have just filed for Chapter 11 the other day, not because they mismanagement or anything. It's because they had this big contract they had signed with Remington Arms, which is another big firearms company, to provide. They were going to build make pistols and Latva was going to make the bodies for them, and they're still waiting for Remington to put in the order, and they made it a big investment in equipment and materials, and they ended up just like basically holding the bag because they're still waiting for Remington, who's supposed to be starting in March, and here we are in July. So they're Chapter 11 just to kind of get protection from their creditors. And it's not that the company's in serious trouble or anything, but they need this break because they're still waiting for Remington to say, you know, let's get going on this.
How are these unemployment numbers, Dean Spiliotis, going to be talked about in the fall elections here in New Hampshire, that 4.4%, right?
Yeah. I think that obviously Democrats will use it as an encouraging sign that the rate has stayed low, maybe not as low as it's been historically. But, you know, they'll draw comparisons to the federal numbers, which are a few points higher. The overriding theme in terms of jobs and employment, I think, in the fall election, both here and nationally, is going to be this income inequality, pushing for a higher minimum wage, living wage, and the very divisive debate on those issues around the country. And I thought Jeff's comment about the gun control bubble, which is what they call this, it fascinates me from a sort of a political psychology standpoint that in the wake of the tragedy in Connecticut, when there was some talk about banning certain types of magazines, there was a run on ammunition
exactly.
To the point where you couldn't buy ammunition. So I think that bubble has finally burst as gun control, the move for reform has kind of bogged down.
Yeah, you think people are pretty much saturated with all the firearms they were buying the last 6 years or whatever. So maybe there's just too many out there.
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests this week are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, and Kevin Landrigan, longtime State House reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. You can join us on these headlines and more. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. And Kevin, I did want to spend a few minutes talking about a very interesting piece that you did this week that we've put on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. It's about whether the Northeast has become saturated with casino gambling. Saturated. Now, give us a little bit more on that exact word.
Sure. The real question here for the Northeast, and a couple of studies have raised this question, is whether the explosion of casinos in the last decade in states, in not only New England states, but particularly in North Atlantic states, Pennsylvania with 15 casinos, Maryland with 5 casinos, Delaware, 2 more casinos, whether essentially the market is saturated, that they're all fighting over this limited pot of discretionary income that gamblers and tourists are going to spend. And Fitch Rating Service from Wall Street, one of the big Wall Street rating firms, sort of raised the first alarm in April when it used that term of the Northeast market is saturated. More recent than that, University of Nevada of Las Vegas, which, surprise, surprise, has a gaming center on its campus, produces national numbers and quarterly numbers on the growth of casino revenue. And it turns out, particularly in the last decade, the Northeast is the only part of the country where revenue from casinos has grown robustly. Keep in mind now, we've gone through this recession, almost the worst one since the last Depression. Casino revenues all over the country depressed. But in spite of all that, in the last decade, Northeast casino revenue is up 70%.
Why because we've built so many, right?
Exactly. And not only it's not only the number, but it's the it's not the quantity, but the quality of the construction that's gone on. Obviously, it started in New England, in with Foxwoods and you know the Mohegan Suns, Fox, both being larger than any casino on the LA Vegas Strip, and even the supporters of casino gambling, not only in this state but analysts throughout, acknowledge that. In order to compete for expanded gambling revenue, you essentially have to build big or go home. That's one of the reasons why Millennium, that's proposed this casino here in Salem at Rockingham Park, a little over a year ago, increased its development plan by $200 million. Why? To essentially say to Massachusetts that has three casinos and a slot barn already on law, that we're going to have a casino big enough with enough amenities that can compete with a casino in Massachusetts. All of these studies are particularly relevant now that Massachusetts is considering a referendum to repeal casinos. If that happens, there is no doubt that many of these casino companies that have plans south of the border are going to come to New Hampshire, because all supporters of expanded gambling insist that the greater Boston metropolitan market is the last frontier in the Northeast. Boston's the largest city in the entire Northeast without a casino within 20 miles of it. So they believe and have full confidence that a casino or casinos can thrive in this market. But obviously the number of casinos is limited and the competition is going to be fierce. That's why you had 11 bidders for the two casinos in the greater Boston market in Massachusetts a few years ago.
Well, I thought the piece was really interesting because it put New Hampshire's debate in this bigger context, not just of New England and the Northeast and different trends, Kevin. I mean, right. And to one extent, Boston is the last frontier. Right. But on the other side, it seems like casinos overall are struggling. So there's two different things going on there. I know you guys want to jump in too. Dean, go ahead.
Yeah, I thought it was a very interesting piece. And the phenomenon that Kevin is describing, I kind of think of as a psychology of the economic silver bullet. What happens is, states that are struggling economically see other states making revenue off of these casinos and say, hey, we should have one too. And, a number of years ago, I lived in Chicago at a time when coming out of the early 90s recession, where every city and town up and down the Mississippi River decided it needed a riverboat casino.
I remember
docked
yeah.
it. And so Chicago had the idea to drop this riverboat in my neighborhood right on the lake on the lake shore, and it was diminishing returns. And I remember, initially there was all this hope that riverboats were going to solve all the economic woes coming out of the recession in the early 90s. And in the end, a lot of these riverboats did not last. And it's the same kind of psychology. Hey, if they're getting money, why don't we have one too? But at some point, you reach the saturation, and the kind of the go big or go home concept really aggravates it.
Yeah, I think probably the best example is what's happened in Atlantic City, which was the original in the East Coast. I remember working at the Star Ledger in Newark when they passed the legislation, and it was going to be the biggest thing in the world. Atlantic City was going to be the new Las Vegas, and if you go one block one way half past the boardwalk, it's still the same Atlantic City, except maybe worse. In recent months, three of the big casinos in Atlantic City have shut down or are in the process of shutting down. Because there is competition, as Kevin said, in Delaware, Pennsylvania,
so
Maryland.
Casinos are shutting down in the Northeast.
Yes, right. Casinos in Atlantic City, in particular, are just not doing well down there. And that was originally the only other place in America besides Las Vegas. But since all these other casinos came, they've been hurt very drastically. It's nowhere near the destination Las Vegas is. Las Vegas is a different animal entirely, different species. But it's really a lesson for people to pay attention to what's happened to Atlantic City about in terms of saturation, in terms of how big your market is.
Let's take a call if we could, gentlemen. Again, the number here in the exchange for our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Scott's in Concord. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi, Laura. First of all, great show. I seldom miss it. Love it.
Great.
I'm against casinos in New Hampshire, quite frankly. And to me, it's like the pro-casino crowd is saying, look, we're going to put a nice, shiny new dumpster right here on your front yard. And don't worry, there won't be any rats. You know,
dumpster, Scott. My goodness.
Well, I think you're going to get an element when you put a casino in. You're going to get an element that is unpleasant, to say the least. I've done a lot of road trips around the country. I've seen a lot of casino towns, and they can keep it. I haven't seen anything that I want associated with it. I will say this, an alternative, I think it's time to get real, probably reinstate the income tax, state income tax, maybe exempt the first $30,000 of income.
Okay. Well, Scott, thank you for calling in. And, you know, Kevin Landergan, just to wrap this up, so you looked at New England in the Northeast. Relate this to how it may affect New Hampshire's debate, these trends that we've talked about, casinos closing elsewhere.
Well, certainly I think the outcome of the referendum in Massachusetts can have a dramatic impact on the debate here.
Now remind us what's happening.
In Massachusetts, the referendum, opponents of casino gambling have put on the ballot a repeal of the 2011 law that legalized casinos in Massachusetts. A license has been approved for a casino in the Springfield, Massachusetts area, and for essentially a slot parlor down in southeast Massachusetts. Attorney General Martha Coakley insisted that these licenses essentially amounted to property that couldn't be taken away by the state. And the state Supreme Court overruled her, essentially said, let the referendum go forward. And polls down in Massachusetts show that it's a very mixed bag, that all the controversies that have occurred in Massachusetts during the licensing process has actually increased opposition to the idea of casinos. If the referendum, as I said, if the referendum passes, there's going to be this flood of companies coming to the state. You're going to see MGM, Wynn Resorts, many other developers say, I've got this piece of property, an option in Hudson, and I'd like to put a destination resort casino here, much like the one I wanted to put in Everett until Massachusetts took it away from me.
Interesting. Let's take one more call if we could. John's calling from Colebrook. Hey, John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. You're all talking about Boston, and that's a really good point. There may nothing near there. But, up here in Colebrook, we're quite close to Quebec. In fact, I can see Lower Canada from my front porch. So I can tell you that there's no casino worthy of the name in our part of Canada. There's one in Montreal, but it's a joke. There's a huge Canadian market. Right across the border here. It's gigantic. Montreal is the second biggest city on the eastern seaboard, if you consider the St. Lawrence Seaway the eastern seaboard. And, of course, the Balsams Hotel may undergo a huge renovation. Les Otten, who developed Sunday River, is now a partner with two local guys, Danny Hebert and Danny Digest.
He has a lot of excitement about that. And, John, I'm going to cut you off because we're heading into a break, but a vote for casinos in the North Country, Scott and Concord said no thank you. We will talk more in just a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the White House faces resistance to spending for the border crisis. Then a surface-to-air missile shoots down a passenger airliner over Ukraine, and Israel launches a ground offensive in the Gaza Strip. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, 10 till noon, here on NHPR. Partly to mostly sunny today, high temperatures upper 70s to lower 80s. Mostly clear tonight, areas of fog after midnight, lows from upper 40s north, ranging upper 50s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Music Festival, presenting works by Schraker, Vivaldi, Bates, and Piazzolla, July 19th at the Silver Center in Plymouth. Tickets at the Silver Center box office and nhmf.org. And Rothweigel Dental Care in Bedford, comprehensive family and cosmetic dentistry devoted to restoring and enhancing the natural beauty of your smile. Information at rothweigeldentalcare.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We've been covering some of the big stories that made headlines this week. Among them, energy policy debated in the North Country among New England governors and Canadian premiers. We've also been talking about casino gambling and whether The Northeast is or is not saturated with casinos. And we've looked at New Hampshire's unemployment rate, the 4.4%, digging into some of those numbers as well. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And gentlemen, from gambling to elections. And Dean, it's summer. And for candidates, that means time to raise money before the primary in early September. What did we find out this week, Dean?
Well, yeah, a lot of the second quarter numbers are in. Basically, we found out that if you're an incumbent, it's a lot easier to raise money than if you're a challenger, which is pretty much in keeping with the sort of standard conventional wisdom in political science. And in the second CD, the kind of the winner at the congressional level in terms of the House districts, Annie Custer raised a little over $500,000 in the second quarter. She has $1.7 million on hand. Carol Shea Porter raised almost $220,000, and she has $612,000 on hand. Now, you look at the challengers, a lot lower. The kind of the highest out of that would be Frank Ginta in the first CD, $132,000. Mara Linda Garcia in the second CD, $128,000. Everybody else is below that. They're also, you know, Frank Ginta has carrying a fair bit of debt as well, so you have to factor that in. But, you know, really the kind of the message is if you're an incumbent, it's easier to raise money. If you're a challenger, you got to work that much harder because there are only so many dollars to go around.
Yeah, and the primary is coming up early September, September 9th, I think. So, yeah, your thoughts, Kevin, on these latest numbers and what they tell us.
Well, it's still early and in the campaign, and certainly candidates, challengers of incumbents have had a lot less time to try and raise money than the incumbent has. But the problem for numbers such as this at a time such as this is that the national fundraising committees for the Republican and Democratic parties have already started to make their decisions about what they're going to spend their money on in the closing weeks before the November election. For example, in New Hampshire, essentially both the national and the Republican and Democratic counterpart committees have committed about $2 million apiece for those last couple of weeks to these two congressional races. But they haven't said which ones and how much. And that's what's troubling in the second congressional district race, certainly for those Republican candidates. You're looking at Annie Custer, who certainly has problems in terms of favorability and had a rough start to her term when she first got elected, but she's sitting on nearly $2 million war chest. And so it's going to be difficult for the second district Republican candidates to convince the Beltway that we have just as good a shot of beating her as Frank Ginta and Dan Innes would have of beating Carol Shea Porter.
So these national interests have to think very strategically, right, and they have to look at which Republican, given limited money, right, which Republican in New Hampshire has a better chance of actually winning. And you're saying, Kevin, they might look more favorably at the first district race rather than the second district.
That's right.
Given the political makeup.
Yep.
And just to jump in real quick, and it's not just the not getting the money. Right. If it becomes public knowledge that you're one of the races that they are not going to fund,
right,
that in itself psychologically is the kiss of death. If they, you know, if it gets out in kind of the public discourse that the RNC or the congressional committees, rather, don't think you're worth the investment, that could tank your candidacy as well.
Yeah, I do think that, especially in the second CD with Gary Lambert and Mara Linda Garcia running there, they're definitely less well known.
And Jim Lawrence.
And they're definitely less well known than Frank Ginta. And actually, Dan Innes, who's running in the primary as well, has something of a national backing because he's openly gay, and there's a different kind of dynamic there.
Yeah, but he's got a lot of national press.
Absolutely, and Peter T. Paul, who they named the school after, he has a super PAC, a PAC that's supporting Dan Innes. So there's some money there. But in terms of the second CD, it's been a tough road to hoe there for those two, especially considering the amount of money that Congresswoman Custer has right now.
All right. Well, as we talk about money and elections, Dean, very quickly, there's controversy this week over a contribution from a labor union made to Maggie Hassan's gubernatorial reelection campaign. Can you untangle this for us,
yeah,
Dean, a little bit?
I'll try. The election law is a little bit murky here in the state. Yeah, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the PAC, gave $25,000 to the Friends of Maggie Hassan on June 12th, which is the same day she officially filed to run for reelection. And the law says typically You can take $5,000 from individuals, both in the primary and the general, $1,000 in each from PACs. But state law does not prohibit kind of committee-to-committee transactions before you're an official candidate. So there's a little bit of a debate here about the timing, about whether she actually got the money after she was officially a candidate. So she has asked Attorney General Foster for kind of, I think, an expedited consideration of this issue to kind of settle it so it doesn't drag on throughout the summer.
And one more campaign issue in the U.S. Senate race. Both Gene Shaheen and Scott Brown courted veterans this week. The other candidates, Bob Smith and Jim Rubens, obviously are doing the same thing. Jeff Feingold, why is this such an important voting block here in New Hampshire? I mean, everyone wants to pay tribute to veterans, but especially in the Granite State.
New Hampshire has a very large population of veterans. It's been like that, as far as I know, forever. And it's a constituency that does vote, is active, and it's you can't ignore that constituency. I just want to say one other thing about this contribution to Governor Hassan.
Sure.
You know, it's interesting to me that it's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, because they are very much in favor of Northern Pass, which kind of we mentioned this earlier. And that's kind of an interesting contribution when you look at it in the whole perspective of the conversation we had earlier in the show.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. Kevin, another quick question for you on veterans. Just remind us why veterans issues, how we treat our veterans, why that issue is getting so much attention this year. I mean, it's always important, but especially important this year.
Well, certainly with the scandal at the VA and all the problems with backlogs of claims, with performance bonuses being falsified out in Phoenix in order to get more money, has prompted Congress, kind of uncharacteristically, to act pretty aggressively in both the House and the Senate on legislation to increase staff at the VA, to reduce some of the backlog of these claims, to give administrators more power to fire and discipline employees. And in New Hampshire, there's a provision in the Senate bill which essentially would allow most veterans in New Hampshire to go to a private hospital for health care. New Hampshire and Alaska are the only states in the country without full-service veterans hospitals. We have clinics in several of them in the state, but no full-service hospital. This provision would essentially say that any veteran who doesn't live within 20 miles of a full-service hospital can go to private health care to receive services. The only folks who would be affected, of course, would be those in the Claremont, Lebanon area who are within the 20-mile radius of the VA hospital in White River Junction.
So the message these candidates are putting out, Kevin, is vote for me, veterans, I'll fix this.
Exactly. Yeah. And as everybody here knows, a new hospital, a new VA hospital in New Hampshire has been a talking point, yes, by politicians in both parties for more than 20 years. Practically, it's not going to happen, and even supporters now acknowledge that. But this is a provision that has a real chance and would give veterans
certainly
the access they need.
Yeah.
All right. Again, the number for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us as we cover some of the issues that made headlines this week, some of the stories that we're talking about, 1-800-892-6477. Dean Spiliotis, vanity plates are back, where
yes,
people
indeed
can spell out fun and meaningful sayings on their license plates. These were held off for a while. We talked about that last week on the program, but just remind us why all of a sudden Granite Staters couldn't get their beloved vanity plates. I've got two of them myself.
Right. This was in the wake of the state Supreme Court decision that an applicant for the license plate, Cops Lie, was in fact entitled to have that plate. So in the wake of that, the state decided to stop temporarily issuing plates. They now have a 2,000 application backlog, which they say they can clear in about 60 days.
That's
it is. Right? But they needed to kind of figure out what the rules are going to be, because there was a lack of clarity, which was part of the decision from the state Supreme Court. So they have an interim rule right now. And that eventually the Joint Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules will pass a permanent version. And the interim rule is very specific in terms of focusing on obscenity, race, gender, religion, ethnicity, all the different ways in which you can run afoul of a proper tag. And my favorite part of the interim rule is it talks about forward, backward, or mirror image. So I love that. They're covering every possible way you could try to hoodwink the DMV. So I didn't know this, but there are 162,000 vanity plates in the state. which brings in almost $7 million in revenue a year. So it's not an insignificant chunk of change. But they're going to get the ball rolling again with this interim rule and try to clear this backlog.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun thing that people in New Hampshire do. And we have a great time when we're driving around the state looking at the vanity plates and trying to figure it out.
Well, you could say New Hampshire is one of the vainest states in the
country. Well, let me just read the interim rule for you. And this is from an article by the Concord Monitor. So thanks to them. The interim rule states that license plates, are you ready? It's very specific, like you said, Dean, cannot refer or be associated with any of the following subjects in any language. Mm-hmm. So we get foreign languages covered, whether read forward, backward, by mirror image, or by phonetic spelling, colon. Intimate body parts or genitals, sexual or excretory acts or functions, words or terms of profanity or obscenity, violence, illegal activities, intoxicants, drugs or drug culture, gangs, or racial, ethnic, religious, gender or sexual orientation, hatred or bigotry. So there you go. Other than that, say what you want.
And you say anything you want about cops, apparently.
There you go. Well, it's interesting that that came back into play this week. Another story that I'd love to update with you, Kevin Landrigan. The toll booth is finally closing in Merrimack. I can't tell you how many times we've talked about this toll booth on the air here. State Senator Peter Bragdon badly wanted this closed. And just as Peter Bragdon wraps up his Senate career, the toll booth is closing.
That's right. Actually, the toll, they stopped collecting tolls starting tonight. Peter Bragdon is a former Senate president, and it should come as no shock. The first Merrimack toll is eliminated because a politician is either offended or politically endangered. In his last election, Peter Bragdon lost the town of Merrimack in a Republican primary. He ended up winning that primary, but it shocked him on that night that it occurred. He jumped with both feet into this Merrimack toll debate. As the Senate president, obviously wielded a significant amount of power. It was attached to the gas tax increase bill this year because Senator Bragdon, who opposed the gas tax increase last year but supported it this year, understood it was the best vehicle. Something was going to happen with the gas tax. And Bragdon, being a studious legislator and from the School of Hard Knocks, also understood government inertia, which is to say, even after the Department of Transportation said we're willing to close this toll booth, they indicated it could take up to 6 months to do it. You'd have to advertise the company that's going to come in and take down the infrastructure, if you will, there, and it could take months to produce new signs. Well, he put into the gas tax bill that this section of the gas tax increase would be effective on July 19th. So essentially giving the state, Department of Transportation, less than 3 weeks to stop charging at the toll booths.
Yeah, to pull down a big chunk of infrastructure. Right. So interesting. Well, toll booths often go up, but they rarely come down.
Right, and the infrastructure isn't down now, and the signs haven't been taken down now. And going back to what I was saying before, that they couldn't possibly have moved this quickly, but because he put the date into the law, it forced their hand. And in the intervening months, this summer and fall, the toll booth structures will be removed.
Well, summer is tourism season. And Jeff Feingold, there was a very interesting story here in Concord having to do with tourists from Washington,
yes,
D.C., our nation's capital, coming up to the beautiful Granite State, escaping the swampy weather of Washington and coming up here. And it turns out, Jeff, that they couldn't legally buy alcohol in New Hampshire.
It's one of the oddest things. When I read that story originally, the clerk, I think it was at the co-op here in Concord.
Yes.
Who I said, well, boy, talk about someone who follows the rules. He just said, there's a state law that says you only can use a state ID or a passport. And so he said, well, the District of Columbia is not a state. So he's, you know, and he refused to serve them alcohol or sell them alcohol. And it became a story, which obviously became a kind of a national story. Mm-hmm. There was a ruling that said, well, you know, actually, let's just say the DMV said, you know, we know that it's not specifically in there, but what are you going to turn down? How many residents are there of D.C. who come up here? And it's, you know, it's something that's pretty important. And obviously, it did raise questions to me about how many times people in D.C. were going to state liquor stores buying liquor. The clerks over there were taking these IDs. So it was just kind of a little funky little summer thing where did this come from? But they've come up with this ruling that says you can use DC.
Yeah, the Liquor
ID.
Commission jumped on it pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
In fact, the guy in question, who was a former, he's New Hampshire native, right, but now lives in DC, yeah, came up. He said he was impressed at how quickly this was changed.
And he was also able to buy elsewhere, apparently. So
yeah,
not everybody's following that law.
Well, could have bought at a state liquor store.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, we love tourists, and, you know, we want them buying the liquor
need
so we can
we
get
need
the
buying
the
booze
the
in
money,
New Hampshire.
Right?
We know that. I mean, that's the main thing.
That's the thing. It just shows you when it comes to collecting money, exactly, particularly from out-of-state residents, New Hampshire's government can move mountains very quickly.
Well, next week on The Exchange, we're going to get reaction here in New England to a very difficult story, the crisis on the U.S. southern border with children fleeing violence in Central America. And this has seemed like a story that it's far away, but now it turns out that some New England states are being asked to help out with this. So we're going to get a New Hampshire take on this story next week. That'll be on Monday. Also, midweek, we're going to sit down with NHPR's president and CEO, Betsy Gardella. She'll catch us up on changes and happenings here at NHPR and obviously take listener questions. So that's some of what we're up to next week. Dean Spiliotis, how about you? What are you going to be watching?
Well, it's the political season. There's lots going on, a lot of candidate visits. So I'm just going to be seeing how the races continue to develop. I think things are still up for grabs, particularly in the second CD on the Republican side. So just going to keep watching those races.
When you say candidate visits, you mean New Hampshire candidates making the rounds?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are also several national candidates coming in for potential presidential vetting. But no, yeah, state races, people doing a lot of retail politicking, turning out. You know, we have market days in Concord this weekend. I know there are going to be a number of local politicians out shaking hands.
Oh, so if I see you down there,
you'll know
I'll
someone
know
else
it's
is
not
nearby.
That you're trying to buy discount flip-flops.
That's
you're
right.
Looking for politicians.
I'm looking for handshaking. Yep.
Jeff Feingold, how about you?
Actually, we're looking at this interesting pending story on Fairpoint Communications, which is in negotiations now with the communication workers. And there's an August 2nd deadline for the contract, and there's a possibility of a strike, but we're not sure. And just the basic financial structure of what's going on at Fairpoint, they've kind of weathered a difficult storm, but what is it like now? And
that's interesting, because they're the big landline provider here.
Absolutely.
In New Hampshire. As more people switch to cell phone only, what's happening with
exactly.
sort of legacy carrier, if I could call it that? That's interesting. Kevin, how about you?
The Legislative Fiscal Committee is meeting next week, and usually that meeting in July is a certain cure for insomnia, but... but there's going to be a lot of discussion about the shape of the budget we just ended with on June 30th, which assumed we were going to have a $26 million surplus. Revenues were only up by $5 million. So the question is, were state agencies, were they able to return as much unspent money as they thought they would? The books won't close till September, but legislative leaders want answers because they're running for re-election.
All right, all of you. Thank you for being here. This is the Friday News Roundup on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, New Hampshire reaction to the surge in unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S.-Mexico border and what it means for the national debate on immigration. Then NHPR President and CEO Betsy Gardella talks about recent changes at the station and later findings from a year-long community conversation on combating drug abuse in New Hampshire. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from your listeners, and the Southern Vermont Dance Festival, 4 days of dance classes, lectures, and performances in Brattleboro and Keene, now through July 20th. Tickets at southernvermontdancefestival.com. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank, providing complete business banking services to small to medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire. Information at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. With 2 weeks to go before August recess, Congress scrambles to craft legislation to address the border crisis. Around the country, more and more communities protest the arrival of immigrant children. Top executives from General Motors testify